From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, why are young people having less sex these days? Journalist Kate Julian has written a piece for The Atlantic magazine looking into the question. She says, with fewer taboos and less shame, this should be a boom time for sex, but it's not. And Julian says there are good reasons for this, but also bad ones, from screens to smartphones to porn to helicopter parents. Today, we're exploring what she calls the sex recession. After this.
Support for KUER comes from local and national businesses across Utah. As a corporate underwriter, your business can support the news, information, and conversations you hear every day on KUER. And our loyal, active listeners will hear about your company and the work it's doing in our community. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, go to KUER.org and click Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a new article in The Atlantic magazine, the journalist Kate Julian includes a statistic from the Centers for Disease Control. From 1991 to 2017, the percentage of high school students who had had intercourse dropped from 54 to 40%. As Julian puts it in the piece, in the space of a generation, sex has gone from something that most high school students have experienced to something now most haven't. And maybe that's a good thing. It certainly is if you're a parent of these kids or a religious minister, but there are also reasons for concern. Today's young adults are on track to have fewer sex partners than the members of the two preceding generations. And the thing is, even the older generations, though, are having less sex today. In her article, Julian says most people might not notice the difference, but when you look at the stats, it adds up to a lot of missing sex. And why? Well, there are a lot of reasons. And today in the program, Kate Julian is joining us to explain what she's learned. Julian is a senior editor at The Atlantic. Her article is in the most recent edition of the magazine. It's called The Sex Recession. A quick warning, as you can probably tell, this is a conversation about sex, and at times it can get a little graphic, so it probably isn't a show for everyone. Kate Julian joined us from the studios of The Atlantic in Washington, D.C. Let's start with the basics, as you do in the article. Like, this should be, as you say, this should be a boom time for sex. It seems like we've lightened up, as you say, on cultural hangups around sex. We don't have as many taboos as we used to. There isn't the same kind of shame. We're just more tolerant. But for the reasons that we'll talk about, it's not a boom time. Just talk about that first, that just sort of general idea.
Well, you're right. It's entirely counterintuitive, right, that in this time that seems more permissive and, you know, in many quarters more sex positive than ever before, that people would be having less sex. Many of the things that sort of historically we thought of as obstacles to sex, both within relationships and outside of relationships, within marriage and outside of marriage, have kind of fallen away. Most Americans, for example, regardless of their religion, do have premarital sex before they get married. Like, that is a fact, and that's been a fact for some time. Right. So what's going on here? And sort of as I started to look at the research, I realized that there probably wasn't a single answer. Yeah. And instead, I sort of came up with a handful of likely suspects. And I think in the case of any given person, a different set of factors may be operating than may be operating for some other person in some other, you know, part of the country in some other situation. Yeah. But I'd be happy to sort of rattle off kind of what those are, if that would be a good way to start.
Yeah, I think that is a good place to start. Like, just mention some of those.
Yeah, so the sort of big overarching point that we have to start with is that most people under 35, adults under 35, I should say, aren't living with a partner, which is a change from the past.
Yeah.
Economics is a big part of that, obviously. So is the fact that a lot of those people are living with their parents. Mm-hmm. And although that may be essential for economic reasons and good for other reasons, it's probably not great for one's sex and dating life in most cases.
Yeah.
one part of this sort of, you know, maybe that people are coming into adulthood with less romantic experience than they had in adolescence than previous cohorts may have. And we don't have a ton of research on that, but there's some indications that that may be the case. Digital distraction is another big part of this, and maybe obviously making people more isolated as they look to sort of solitary entertainments. Porn is one part of that. But not only as a substitute for sex, it may be that learning about sex from porn is having some downsides, which we can get to later.
We will, yeah.
And then dating apps are a confusing part of this, and that it would seem that they're making it more easy to partner with people and to find dating and other partners. But in fact, they really don't work very well for a large segment of the population.
They're just distracting us, right?
They're distracting. And for some people, they're really demoralizing and they can actually really be counterproductive. And then finally, depression, anxiety, poor self-image generally, all things that seem to be rising, especially among young people, are well known to be basically turnoffs, libido killers. So that's a part of this as well.
What about the grown-ups, people from older generations? Are they having less sex too, as far as you can tell?
So the research that I'm using as a springboard for this article by Jean Twenge, who's a psychologist at San Diego State, does suggest that adults up to about the age of 60, I want to say, are having sex less frequently than past generational cohorts did at the same age.
Yeah.
So that is, you know, somebody who's 50 now seems to be having sex less frequently than somebody who's 50 did in the 90s. I believe the number is – it's gone from 62 times a year on average to 54 times a year on average. Now – that doesn't seem like a huge drop in a given person's life. It's still sort of roughly once a week.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, in percentage terms and when you sort of consider it nationally, actually, you know, a surprising drop.
And we should also point out, and we'll get into this because there's some dynamics of this I found really interesting, but this is not just an American phenomenon.
There's been some attention here to changes in Japan and how fewer Japanese people are getting married. And, of course, this has been tied to their really low fertility rate at this point. But I discovered that other countries that study their citizens' sex lives – and I should say that's not most countries but the handful of wealthy ones that have national sex surveys in one sort or another – are finding similar declines. So this is in Australia. This is in the UK, in Finland. In the Netherlands, with regard to adolescents specifically, similar trends are being noted.
Well, it's interesting that in some countries they're considering this a political issue, like that, like there's a real sense of concern in some of these countries. Not like, oh, this is great. Fewer people are having
sex.
They're like, oh, no, people are not having as much sex. That's a problem.
Absolutely. I thought this was fascinating. So in the case of the Netherlands, specifically on the teenage front, you know, the decline in teen sex and the delay in sexual activity among teens has been rightly lauded in this country and pretty much seen as wonderful news from every quarter. And in a lot of ways, it is good news, right? The teen pregnancy rate is a third of what it was in the early 90s. That's terrific.
Yeah.
More people are likely to say that their first sexual experience was wanted and welcomed when it did happen. That's also terrific. But the problem is sort of what's causing that delay. Is the delay happening for good reasons because people are feeling free to say no or they're doing things on their own terms in accordance with their values? Or is it happening because they're more isolated? And in the Netherlands, you know, this survey that I'm referring to found other things had also been pushed back, including holding hands with another person, kissing another person. And there was some commentary there that I thought was really compelling, sort of saying if teenagers aren't having experience with flirtation, with heartbreak, with disappointment, with all these sort of quintessential teen experiences, is that going to leave them less equipped for the sort of ups and downs of adulthood? In Sweden, some newspaper polling suggested a similar trend, although there hadn't been a national sex survey there in 20-plus years. And so the then health minister a couple of years ago announced that they were going to do another sex survey. And he wrote an op-ed that I thought was quite compelling, essentially saying if the conditions for a healthy sex life among adults are not present or declining in our society, we should actually see that as a political issue.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing that was, I think, so interesting about your story is that on one hand, there's real legitimate concern. And and one of the things you're concerned about and seem to be sort of focused on is this question of happiness. So that's on one hand. But then the other thing is that there are, as you mentioned in the piece, some kind of hopeful theories here as well. One surprising theory is that one reason fewer people are having sex is a decrease in childhood sexual abuse, for example, which is really interesting.
No, that's fascinating. I thought that, you know, this is known to lead teenagers to have sex earlier, probably in unhealthy ways.
Yeah.
And as those rates have declined, you would expect that to lead, you know, there to be a statistically significant delay among those people who haven't been abused. Similarly, when we're talking about adults, you know, Debbie Herbenick, who's a wonderful sex researcher at Indiana University, pointed out to me, look, you know, 25 years ago, I think, or something along those lines, you know, marital rape was still legal in a couple of states.
Yeah.
I mean, the sort of recency with which people have felt comfortable saying no to sex they don't want to have is something that we shouldn't miss here. That's part of this as well.
And it made me wonder, like, changing gender norms, more awareness, people just aren't feeling pressured to have sex they don't really want right now or aren't really equipped for yet. And so I wonder, and we'll dig into this a bit later, but is it possible that this is just kind of a new sexual set point, like a more realistic standard that we've taken out some of the negative factors like pressure and abuse, and this is just kind of where we've landed?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, we can't say, like, what is the correct amount of sex? There is no such thing, right?
Yeah.
So we can see – what we can see here is that something is changing. And I would say that change is not all bad, and it's not all good either. It's just it's an interesting sort of impetus to sort of take stock of where we are. And, you know, I found plenty of evidence in both directions.
Yeah.
But there is no sort of perfect set point. Absolutely not.
Let's talk about the parts that you found that were concerning, because as you write, this could have broader implications, a broader, as you put it, withdrawal from physical intimacy. And let's talk about go back to Japan. You mentioned Japan is interesting. A lot of people saw Japan and its declining sex rate as, you know, this kind of weird, kind of strange outlier. But you say that it's not a curiosity necessarily as much as a cautionary tale when you really look into it. And because this technology that they're developing is related to sex for one. And that's one of the – talk a little bit about this idea, sex for one.
Yeah. So there are a couple things just backing up very briefly in Japan that are worth noting. One, the country has long had one of the leading global sort of porn industries. They have a high rate of porn use and they export porn to the rest of the world. They've been a leader in that department. Then the other thing that's gone on there, of course, is sort of economic decline and stagnation, which really changed the labor market there and also left – you know, a generation with really uncertain economic prospects and sort of the feeling that they couldn't easily sort of match the standard of living that their parents had enjoyed and might not be marriageable as a result. And so what we see is this in the past 15 years, there's been the rise of this sort of category of young men in Japan who are known in Japanese, the direct translation is, as grass-eating men or herbivore men. So this is like a sort of recognized social category there of young men who are not interested in romantic relationships or sex with another person. But what I found really curious is that it doesn't necessarily mean that people have lost their sort of appetite for sexual stimulation. There's, in fact, you know, rather, you know, booming market for products and services that make masturbation more enjoyable.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's interesting. And we can't necessarily say that masturbation there or here is necessarily substituting for sex, but it does seem like in the Japanese case something like that may be happening.
Well, one of the things you write about is masturbation is one of those taboos that has been around for a long time, in this country anyway, and seems to be falling away. So say something about the ideas of this psychologist, Philip Zimbardo. Because he thinks the rise in masturbation has these kind of broader, kind of troubling implications for young men.
Yeah. So Philip Zimbardo, the famous Stanford psychologist who's best known for the Stanford prison experiment some decades ago, has more recently written a book called Man Interrupted, which discusses broadly what he sees as sort of the predicament of young men today and the various reasons that they are failing compared to past cohorts of young men academically, socially, romantically. And the book is not only about pornography and masturbation, but that is a major theme of it. He also talks about other kinds of digital entertainments, video gaming and so forth. And he has this sort of portmanteau he uses in the book. He refers to procrasturbation. Right. I've never said that out loud before. Procrastination via masturbation.
Yep.
And there may be something to that. I mean, he comes along with, you know, other anti-masturbation messages and movements that have sprung up over the last several years, ranging from NoFap, which is a website spin-off of a popular Reddit board started by a former Google contractor, which is designed to sort of help people who believe they have sort of compulsive masturbation habits to sort of control that behavior. And
it's kind of like the thing I thought, Kate, was the argument being made sounds a little like what you often hear about marijuana, that it tamps down ambition and the desire to create relationships because you're stoned all the time. Gavin McInnes, you mentioned this of NoFap.
Yes,
he's making the same argument, and I'm wondering, after your reporting, do you buy it?
So I don't see masturbation by itself as like the sole cause or even necessarily a leading cause. I see it more as a subset of digital entertainment generally.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily think that masturbation is causing any of this more than, say, Netflix. That is to say, there are a bunch of things that are available to us right now that can keep us pretty happily occupied at home and may sort of relieve in the short term some of the incentive to go out into the physical world and engage with other people. And so I would be very wary of efforts to sort of say this is just a porn or masturbation problem. And in fact, you know, several of the young men I spoke to made a point of saying this, like my porn habit and my sort of sex life, insofar as I have one or if I have one, are really separate things.
Mm-hmm.
And moreover, you know, yes, you know, porn may sometimes sort of take the edge off of my appetite for the real thing. But, you know, so do many other things sort of take the edge off my appetite to go out, as I was just saying, into the real world. So I think it's a bit too simplistic to just pull that one part of it out when there's video gaming and streaming TV and social media and all these other kinds of new ways of keeping ourselves busy.
Well, it gets us to Salt Lake City, which you referenced one organization here called Fight the New Drug. And the drug, of course, is, from their point of view anyway, is porn. And this is pretty disputed, and you mentioned this in the article, whether porn is actually technically addictive.
Yeah. This is such a hot and contentious thing. I'm not really going to wade in on it other than to say that it's far from a settled question. And the researchers I spoke to were skeptical that this was an established thing.
You mentioned the 24-year-old who said something to you that I thought made a lot of sense, that the ease of internet porn supplies people with, I liked how he put it, just enough satisfaction to, as he said, placate the imperatives. He seemed to be saying that it didn't replace the need for a real relationship necessarily, but it kind of relieved enough sexual pressure to make them feel satisfied so they didn't have to go out looking. And if you follow that logic, couldn't that mean that people now don't have to be looking for relationships just to satisfy their sexual desire, and that in some ways they could have more meaningful reasons for finding a partner?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's fascinating, and this is something I didn't raise in the piece, but it's something that one of the really smart sex therapists I spoke to, a man named Ian Kerner in New York, said, which is that he believes in his practice he's seeing more younger married couples who come to him having chosen each other for reasons that really had nothing to do with sexual attraction.
Yeah.
And he's been a therapist for quite some time, and I think that's interesting that he's noted that shift, you know, that this may not rate as high on the list of you know, really critical things for people.
Mm. One of the things you seem to have found is that the sex drive, this is how you put it, is more fragile than we thought. Like it's easier to short circuit than we may have thought.
I think that's right. I think the way we talk about sex is actually quite misguided. I came to this sort of realization over the course of my reporting as I talked to really thoughtful sex researcher after sex researcher who would say, essentially, it's not a drive. Can you get people to understand that it's not a drive? This isn't like our need for hunger or sleep. They're just not comparable. You know, it's a reward system. It's something that makes us feel good and that we therefore like to do. But it's not something that is essential. I quote the sex writer and researcher Emily Nagoski late in the piece, who likes to say, you know, nobody ever died of not getting laid. And that's quite right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, this is an optional activity. We don't need it, although that's not to say that it doesn't have some benefits to us as a species and as individuals.
I wanted to ask you about the conversations you had with a lot of young adults, people in their 20s and early 30s. And as you point out, like, it wasn't a scientific sample, but it did seem to yield some interesting insights. Like, you found these different themes. What were the conversations like, first of all, and were people fairly open to share this information?
I found I was really pleasantly startled by how open people were and how much they wanted to talk. I mean, you know, some of these conversations I would get on the phone in the evening thinking we'll talk for 10 or 15 minutes, and it would stretch on after an hour – or over an hour, I should say. You know, I think being able to talk to somebody – sort of outside the context of your day-to-day life, who's sort of asking questions that help you to put your own experiences in context and where you can weigh in on, you know, an unnamed basis. I didn't use the real names of people.
Yeah.
Really led people to kind of be quite open. I did do some of my back and forth via email as well for some of the – and in writing. Some of the more sensitive topics were easier for some people to discuss that way. But not entirely. One thing that I thought was really interesting too was the number of people who volunteered, not prodded by me, that they wished that they had been young at a different time.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really poignant. You know, this was like a refrain almost. Like, I don't – this, has it always been this hard? Was it this hard for my parents? I don't think that it was. And of course, I also spoke to people who were madly in love and engaged and, you know, having fabulous love lives or sex lives and or some combination thereof.
Yeah.
But among the people for whom things weren't really working, it's really sort of just heartbreaking.
Yeah. You mentioned some of the misconceptions that we have about sex. And this sort of gets us to this idea of hookup culture. All the hyperventilating, as you put it, that's been going on about this so-called hookup culture. It seems like in some ways it's kind of a myth.
I think it is. I mean, I think something does seem to have changed, but I think we've sort of noticed the thing that remains instead of the thing that's gone away.
Yeah.
And here's what I mean by that. So, you know, teenagers in the late 90s and early 2000s don't seem to have been hooking up more than Gen Xers did in the 80s and in early 90s. They may have been having relationships less, however.
Yeah.
So that is to say, like, something has changed, but people kind of put their finger on the wrong thing. And they looked at, the thing that was left as opposed to the thing that had gone away. And I do want to emphasize that the research on this is really not super robust. Most of the research on teenagers tends to be more public health oriented. You know, are they pregnant? Do they have diseases? When do they have, you know, sex for the first time? And it's less oriented towards some of the questions that the Dutch survey I mentioned was asking. You know, have you held hands with somebody? Have you kissed them? You know, more qualitative questions that would get at sort of what people's actual sort of romantic experiences are like. And I think that's beginning to change. I think there is some new research attention to adolescence as a really crucial developmental phase that really helps prepare people for adulthood. But that research is pretty nascent.
Kate Julian, she's a senior editor at The Atlantic. Her article, The Sex Recession, is the cover story in the December edition of the magazine. We have a link to it on our website. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
You hear stories on KUER. They make you think and laugh. Sometimes they frustrate you, and sometimes they even make you cry. When that happens, what's the first thing you want to do? Share the story, of course. And thankfully, local stories you hear on the air wind up at KUER.org. You'll find news, podcasts, and all the Radio West you want. plus community events. When you hear a story you love, spread the love at KUER.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, this question: why are young people having less sex these days? We have with us the journalist Kate Julian, who has written a piece for The Atlantic magazine looking into the question. It's called The Sex Recession. Another quick note of warning: today's conversation is about sex, and there are moments when we use some graphic language. We talk about certain sex acts, so it's not a show for everyone. Lisa Wade at Occidental College told you that young people have always been most likely to have sex when it's in the context of an actual relationship. So there's a kind of biological imperative there that I found kind of reassuring that, maybe we were all freaked out about so-called hookup culture in the 90s. But in fact, people generally tend to have sex when they have a relationship.
Yeah, no, I spoke to her relatively late in my reporting, and it was such an aha moment because it shouldn't have been, right? It should be an obvious point, right? If we think to our own lives and the lives of people we know, most people have – not all, but more people than not seem to have sex for the first time in the context of a relationship, whether that's in their teens or in their 20s. That is just usually what happens. And so, yes, as she notes, the teen pregnancy rate was at its all-time high in the late 50s, which was the time of going steady.
Yeah.
And that was a real change from sort of dating culture among teenagers before World War II, where it was much more oriented toward sort of one-off dates as opposed to going steady.
One of the things that you write about is how these shifts have coincided with the very involved parent, the helicopter parent. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, kids' time is more structured now. There's less free time. I love this. You quote one writer, Malcolm Harris, who put it this way: "It takes idle hands to get past first base, and today's kids have a lot to do."
I love that quote so much. I wish I'd thought of that myself, but it's so well put. So I do talk about this in the piece in the context of sort of so-called helicopter parenting and the idea that teens are more scheduled. I will pause and say that I do think that that may be true unequally true. I think that's more true for college-bound kids perhaps than for other kids. It may be more true for kids who are heavily involved in sports than for other kids. There definitely are sort of gradations here. One thing that I think is interesting about parenting, which I don't go into specifically in the piece, is the way that smartphones or really cell phones in general have changed the relationship between kids and their parents. I think there's just a lot more accountability and a lot more knowledge of where your kid is at a given time. Or if you're the kid, your parents are much more likely to know where you are. I remember sort of as a teenager in the early to mid 90s, you know, this kind of, you know, blissful time of the afternoon where nobody knew exactly what I was up to and where I was. Right. And certainly people got up to some not so good things in that time, and maybe some good things as well.
Yeah.
But I think that is another aspect of all of this. Jean Twenge, who I cited earlier, whose research I draw on, has looked at the way that adolescence has changed more broadly. She had a book that came out last year called iGen that The Atlantic ran an excerpt of, where she just looks at a number of changes in adolescence that seem to have unfolded in the last 15 years or so, including the fact that teens are much less likely to get a driver's license when they turn 16 than they were. They're less likely to go outside of the house without their parents, perhaps because more of their social life is unfolding sort of digitally or on their phone. And those things obviously go hand in hand with this as well.
That you talk about this course at Northwestern University, Marriage 101, which is incredibly popular. And the instructor now, psychology professor Alexandra Solomon, she's come to these conclusions about hookup culture. Talk a little bit about what she's found about this sort of lack of relationship culture. Because one of the things you write about is that she says this is an effect of what she calls social stunting.
So Alexandra Solomon, like quite a few professors I spoke to actually who teach big undergraduate surveys courses that are related to sex or relationships in some way, has found that her office hours have become almost – I mean, yes, people come for assistance with things and involved with the course directly, but they also just come to her wanting relationship advice. Yeah. And it's almost become sort of drop-in therapy hours. And as I say, I heard this from a number of other professors too, and they also noted that it had sort of changed, that this was sort of more so over the past 10 years or so. And I think she came to feel in the course of these conversations that people's lives did seem to be a bit different than her own life as an undergraduate at Northwestern, as it happens, in the 90s. And so, yeah, she has a great quote from one of her students who says, we hook up because we don't have social skills. We don't have social skills because we hook up. Or maybe it was the other way around. But at any rate, you know, she felt that certainly, you know, most people in her class do have a relationship at some point over the course of their college career. I don't mean to say that nobody's having a relationship, but that it seemed to be less prevalent and less frequent than it was when she had been a student there. And she felt that there was, you know, that more people were arriving on campus without romantic experience perhaps than might have been the case in the past, and that it was sort of hard to get going as a result. I think she also found that there were, you know, quite a few students, and this also sort of goes with the research that I mentioned in the piece and that you alluded to a moment ago by Lisa Wade at Occidental, who's written a really good book about hookup culture. Sort of most people actually don't engage in it, at least not very much. A lot of people feel left out by it, and they don't really know what, you know, if there's a way to engage with people that's not on those terms.
Solomon also talked about how young people are seeing relationships as getting in the way of their career pursuits. Like, that's secondary. That seems kind of like a significant, like big time significant social change in some way.
I think that's right. I mean, she talked about how I think she's written, you know, students say to her they're trying actually really hard not to fall in love because they feel like it will complicate things and derail the question of where do I go next and what do I do. It will almost be an encumbrance. And I heard this from quite a few people. And, I think that for young women especially, there's a feeling that, you know, you would be limiting yourself or holding yourself back if you sort of did something so kind of old-fashioned as you know, putting a partnership before your own career. And I can understand that. I mean, obviously, when you graduate from college, you're 21, you're 22, you're quite young, and the country is big. A place like Northwestern draws people from all over the place, and it is complicated. But it was interesting. Yeah.
This idea that we were talking about this earlier, these apps like Tinder and Bumble and OkCupid, stuff like that. There's this idea that they're facilitating a ton of sexual encounters. But as you said, like, that doesn't seem to be the way it's playing out. In fact, you call it a Tinder mirage.
Yeah, exactly. There was a famous Vanity Fair, I think, cover story several years ago that got quite a bit of attention called the Tinder Apocalypse. Yeah. So this was a very subtle kind of reference to that. You know, that sort of argued that, like, you know, a young man in his prime could easily have 100 sexual partners a year, you know, with the help of Tinder if he so desired. And, you know, there may be some people who are doing that. There doubtless are some people who are doing that. But it's definitely not the experience of most people. And not most people wouldn't want that.
Certainly not someone like Simon, 32-year-old grad student, shortish, balding. Mm-hmm. So he's not the, like, you know, hunk that.
No, he's not. Right? Simon is so lovely and so funny. I mean, he's just in my written exchanges with him and in our conversation. I mean, he's just the kind of person you want to talk to and who makes you laugh. He's the kind of person who sort of shines in real life but doesn't really shine in a photo. I think it's fair to say, which is probably true for many of us. And so he's in his early 30s now, maybe 31 or 32. At the end of college in 2007, he got into a long-term relationship, and the relationship lasted for 7 years. When he came out of that relationship in 2014, the world was pretty different. When the relationship had started, there were no iPhones, or iPhones were just coming out. There were no dating apps. And when he came out, you know, of the relationship, all of that had changed. And so he'd been in this relationship for a long time, and he wanted to sort of meet some women for whatever. And he sort of did what he would have done as a senior in college and went to bars and sort of tried to chat people up and was like, gosh, I'm really striking out right and left in a way that, you know, that wasn't the case before. What's going on? And he came to the conclusion that over a pretty short period of time, it had just become a little bit weirder to strike up a conversation with someone in person. There was almost a sense that, like, this is not really the appropriate venue. Like, don't you have a phone? Like, can't you do this? Can't you do this the normal way? And so then he did sign up for the various apps. In fact, actually, his friends signed him up first because they were like, bars are no longer where it's at, Simon.
Yeah.
So he got on several of them. And he is he's sort of a very intellectual, kind of by his own description, sort of nerdy guy. And so he was actually sort of rather systematic in kind of keeping some stats on his experience with Tinder. And he found that, you know, for every woman he swiped right on, or for every 30 women, I should say, that he swiped right on, sort of a match would be triggered.
Yeah.
But then that was just the beginning, because then you have to start a text exchange with the person. And he found that for every 10 women he quote-unquote matched with, only one of them would write him back. And I don't think that's because he was a bad texter. I mean, as I say, he's actually quite sort of charming and is clever and has sort of a good way with words. So when you sort of do all the calculation through, it's like for every 300 women he swiped right on, he was having a text exchange, a two-way text exchange with one. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you mentioned is someone told you that it's more a game now than anything else. They've gamified interaction.
Yeah. This woman I call Iris said to me quite bitterly, actually, when I was talking to her in person over a glass of wine, they've gamified Tinder. And I didn't understand. It was one of my first interviews. And I was like, they who? What? What's she talking about?
Yeah.
And I kept hearing different versions of this from other people, which is that Tinder had become just one more app to sort of mess around with on your phone, sort of in idle moments. It was a diversion. Insofar as people did match with you, it was sort of an eco boost, like, oh, look, little dopamine hit. Somebody liked my picture.
Yeah.
But it wasn't necessarily something that everybody was doing with the idea of actually meeting up with a person in real life. Now, I do want to emphasize that for some people, apps really do work well. I mean, they are by some measures the leading way that people are meeting each other now, right?
Yeah.
And that goes to the point about why this has become the acceptable way to meet people. People who meet that way are more likely, in fact, to get married sooner rather than later compared to people who meet other ways. So if you're really dogged about it and know what you're doing and are organized, I think it can be good. The problem is I talked to so many people who were sort of saying, well, yeah, I download them when I'm watching TV and then I sort of swipe a little bit and then I disinstall the app. And if you're on the other end of that, I think it's got to be bewildering, you know, all these people are swiping on me and then none of them follow through. What did I do?
Yeah. Well, it gets to something that you mentioned, like there was this on one hand, you don't want a bunch of creepy, douchey guys approaching you and hitting on you. So in this new age of kind of, you know, new awareness about sexual harassment, we're in the Me Too movement. I mean, that's a good thing. But then you talk about your own experience, how you met your husband in an elevator. And you say in the article, when you told women that, a lot of them would say, gosh, that would be so great, but then maybe it would also be weird to have someone try to sort of engage you in an elevator. So it seems just really good and bad and kind of confusing.
Absolutely. Yeah. The elevator thing prompted these interesting responses along the lines of what you say. And I had another woman sort of fantasized about how she would really like to meet somebody in a bookstore. She felt that that would be – she lived in New York and that would be the ideal way to meet somebody. And she had this whole sort of reverie almost about it. And then she snapped out of it and sort of said, but that would never happen. And, you know, when you watch TV shows from the 90s, they're all highly unrealistic. And she was referring to things like Sex and the City and Friends, where people meet each other in bars or cafes. But here's what's interesting. You know, I'm not sure how many people actually ever did meet in bars and cafes. I mean, people meet all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
There almost seems to be this kind of nostalgia for a vision of something that may have existed more. It may not have existed quite to the extent that people imagine that it did.
Yeah.
But people seemed really hungry for that, and yet also to think that if somebody talked to them in real life, it would seem, well, unseemly.
Yeah. Let's talk about the section in the article that you call bad sex, painfully bad sex, mm-hmm. because this gets us back to Debbie Herbeneck, a professor at Indiana University. She's a sex researcher there. You mentioned her before. And she talked about how these, I'm not sure how to put it, sexual techniques and maneuvers from porn are influencing expectations about sex. And it's causing some really, really bad first sexual experiences or bad sexual experiences in general for women and other people.
Yeah. And I think this is probably particularly true for people's early sexual experiences. And as things go on, whether in the context of a relationship or not, people may sort of correct their behavior. But she has some ongoing research, which isn't published yet, so I don't have exact numbers, but that show that among people in their late teens, some behaviors that might surprise you are surprisingly prevalent. And these behaviors are behaviors that are not coincidentally probably prevalent in porn. They include choking. They include anal sex among heterosexuals. The rate of that among young people has doubled over not very many years. Yeah. They include some other things that I may not go into on the radio.
I'll just mention one, and we may as well just say it. Ejaculating on a woman's face, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So Debbie says to her undergrads now, she says, if you're with somebody for the first time, please do not try the following things. Like, do not choke them. Do not ejaculate on their face. Yeah. Do not try to have anal sex with them. Because these are, although some people are into those things, statistically speaking, these are not likely to go over well.
Yeah.
In my interviews with young women particularly, this kept coming up. The choking thing was the one that people mentioned the most frequently. I think because it was uniquely and viscerally kind of disturbing and almost traumatic, and also because perhaps they felt more comfortable talking about that than some of the other things that we've just referred to. But, you know, one young woman said, you know, I've had a few sexual encounters, and each one the young man tried to choke me, and I thought that that was normal. Depends on, I suppose, what we mean by normal. Yeah. And I will pause and say, you know, autoerotic asphyxiation is a thing, or rather erotic asphyxiation. Some people are into that. It's dangerous, you know, between consenting adults. You know, I'm not going to judge it, but it's really not something that you should do to somebody without their willingness and permission and desire. And so it seems that, you know, if you're looking to porn, you know, as a 12, 13, 14-year-old boy or girl, for that matter, you may get a rather distorted view of reality in the absence of other information, either conversations with a parent or a really high-quality sex education. So it's not just that the problem is porn per se. Perhaps it's the problem that it is learning about sex from porn in the absence of other information.
Yeah.
And some of this also went not just to the sort of behaviors that I just described, but just to unrealistic notions of sexual response. A lot of the women described, you know, having sexual encounters, these are women in their 20s, with men who really seemed to expect that they would be able to climax like porn stars do from things that just physiologically aren't realistic for most women. And, you know, if you know, female sexual response is really diverse. This is something that Debbie Herbeneck's research speaks to. Women have vastly different physical preferences and physiology. And, you know, it's just not a recipe for figuring that out, I think, if you're, you know, having sex outside the context of a relationship and you're sort of going by what you've seen in porn.
And this one surprised me a lot, too. And this may be an effect of porn, too, at least in part, is millennials, you found out, don't like to get naked. I mean, there's a lot of discomfort with nudity. What is that about?
So this is so interesting. A sex researcher named Justin Lee Miller, who's at Ball State University, pointed this out to me in one of my early conversations when I was sort of casting about for what's going on here. He sort of said, I think sort of new modesty or physical insecurity is part of it. And I sort of thought, well, that doesn't make any sense. People are more uninhibited than ever, like, see, for example, sexting, right?
Yeah.
And he said, well, but think about the gym thing. And I work out at home, and I really didn't actually know what he meant. I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, millennials are much less comfortable being naked in the gym locker than older groups. And As I looked into it, I found that this is actually true. Gyms around the country, like newer gyms, are trying to sort of change their architecture and design to enable more private changing areas. And when I started to ask men that I know, like, is there a generational difference between younger men and older men in a gym locker room, everybody said, oh, yeah, the old guys let it all hang out.
Yeah.
And the younger men are changing under a towel.
Yeah.
And so it's counterintuitive, and yet it's not. I mean, there are some simple explanations for all of this. One that I mentioned in the article is that in the early 90s-ish, most public high schools stopped having students shower after gym class. And so people just have less experience being nude in a kind of group setting, and that would make them less comfortable in that setting in a gym down the line, of course. But I also wonder if there's a new level of physical insecurity. And the research we have on social media use, particularly heavy social media use, suggests that people who are heavy users have considerably lower self-image and body image. There's also some research looking at out of Europe on young men's attitudes toward their bodies and their consumption of pornography, and found that young men who consume more pornography feel much more insecure about their genitals and their physical appearance naked than other men.
Well, this gets to, again, sort of the a theme in the piece that as you talk about that paralyzing and vicious cycle that unhappiness and abstinence can be. So say something about that, because you believe these rising rates of unhappiness is contributing to this too.
And ultimately, I think that's right. I mean, I talk late in the piece about sort of an emerging realization among sex researchers over maybe the last 15 years, 20 years, and this comes out of research at the Kinsey Institute at Indiana again, that although the way most of us think and talk about sex really involves, and the appetite for sex, sexual arousal, really focuses on turn-ons, right? What fuel, what one researcher sort of uses as the analogy of a gas pedal.
Yeah.
And so if you want to have sex, you just need to add fuel or erotica stimulus. And it's coming to be apparent that inhibition, in which this same researcher sort of compared to the brakes in a car, is as much of a factor, if not more of a factor, and it seems to be especially a factor for women, that if something is inhibiting you, making you stop, making you sort of think about why you don't want to have sex, that will ultimately be a more important determination of whether or not you're having sex. And this, you know, this concept is, it applies sort of broadly. So we could be talking about really anything. It could be depression. It could be anxiety. It could be the poor self-image that we were just talking about. It could even be sleep deprivation, just anything that makes you feel not in the mood or not up for it. The sleep part of this I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
There's one study that found that if a woman gets an extra hour of sleep, she's like 16% more likely to have sex the next day. And so in a way, I came to see sex almost as a sort of a weather vane for our overall well-being. And my ultimate concern here is not so much the sex itself, so much as there's a really large body of research suggesting that people who are happy and healthy in a whole bunch of different regards are more likely to have happy and healthy sex lives. And the reverse seems to be true as well.
Yeah.
That is, having a happy and healthy sex life is a pretty significant happiness booster. And so you realize that there's almost a vicious cycle or circle here where, you know, somebody who's unhappy is less likely to be having a romantic and sexual life that's fulfilling, and somebody who doesn't have a romantic and sexual life that's fulfilling is more likely to be unhappy. And so, you know, which comes first, it's hard to say. Certainly when we're talking about depression and anxiety, this is a particularly sort of bitter irony, because both of those things depress libido, and yet the treatments for them do as well.
Well, it gets to sort of something you mentioned at the end. Like, you had expected big picture issues to be the sort of the stuff that you were going to focus on. But, like, you know, as we said, all this sort of social changing social conventions, economic insecurity, all this other stuff. But instead, your concerns were pretty basic. Like, it's about that relationship between sex and just well-being, wellness.
Exactly. I mean, if people are choosing to not have sex for some of the sort of positive reasons that we discussed earlier, that's terrific.
Yeah.
And so far as that's happening, I'm happy to hear it. what concerns me more is that this is sort of a symptom of people being unable to connect with each other and having sort of, you know, even in the context of relationships, you know, their phones distract them from their in-person sort of interactions with other people. And that does seem troubling. And I think that we might want to sort of take it as seriously as the Swedish health minister I was invoking earlier does, and say that this is a warning sign, right? This is a sort of symptom, perhaps, that something's not quite right in our in the way we're living at this moment.
Let me ask you this finally, because you write about how not unlike Simon, you know, he had this experience. He was in a relationship, and then when he breaks up, it's like he's gone through this time machine and everything's changed. And you write about how you yourself, you're not so much older than a lot of the young adults you were talking to, but you felt like, you said, you were from a different time. Like it's just, and one really passionate feminist said to you, let me quote this. She said, there are a lot of lonely, confused people out there who have no idea what to do or how to date. It just seems really confusing and kind of sad.
Yeah. So that woman was talking specifically in the context of the post-Me Too kind of moment, which she overall sort of very much welcomed, right? Was saying there are a lot of really healthy adjustments and reckonings going on right now, but we haven't really caught up with that. And some of these changes may really be things that just take a while to work out. I mean, one sex researcher I spoke to said that he thought there had been two big changes in really fast or dramatic, I should say, changes in human courtship. And one was this, you know, over thousands of years.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, maybe it takes us some time to figure out how to use apps and how not to use apps. Maybe the post-Me Too reckoning takes some time to figure out. I mean, there's some interesting research, for example, quickly suggesting that most men wish women would make the first move more, and yet most women are not doing so. So, you know, hopefully we can find some sort of more productive ways to respond to these things. And ultimately, I really hope that people who are struggling a bit with this, who are in their 20s, some of those people who I referred to earlier saying, I wish I were from a different time, or was it always this hard? I just hope that people who are having that experience realize that they're not alone. That was sort of one of the more powerful experiences I had in talking to people, is how often relieved they felt at the end of the conversation when I would say, well, you know, you're not alone. Statistically, you know, your experience is becoming more common. And there was just this almost audible sigh of relief.
Kate Julian, she's a senior editor at The Atlantic. Her article, The Sex Recession, appears in the December edition of the magazine. She joined us from the studios of The Atlantic in Washington, D.C. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.